once more under the breach, dear friend.
Now let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and Jake McClure. And
we did it. We said our names.
We did. We actually...
the skills that require.
How
People
many years,
don't realize.
How many years of harmonious... that sounds like the name of a Chinese dish or something. Of harmonious pronunciation, have we... How many years of practice?
What?
14, 16?
Those are two different questions. You just asked how many years of practice and how many years of harmonious. We haven't quite made it to a year of harmonious pronunciation.
Well, yeah, but
we're still not very good at saying our names. It's very exciting when we do.
What is it, 16 years? 17 years.
I wish. It's 17 years. Yeah.
What do you get?
Another day older and deeper in debt.
There it is. You're listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. In case you missed that brilliant announcement a moment ago, the Personal Wealth Coach, this is disclosure, is both the name of this radio presentation and the name of an investment advisory firm, wealth management firm, registered with the United States Securities Exchange Commission and Exchange Commission.
In Salado, Texas.
In Salado, Texas. So now you have been properly disclosed.
And we already have a caller.
Yes, we
got
have a caller
on the wrong dial there.
I do.
Yeah.
Yes.
There you go.
The telephone number's in here. If you'd like to interject a question, thought, or comment, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And it's all dependent on the fact that today is March 21st, 2015. So caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, maybe.
Hello, caller.
Now, caller, you're on the air.
You're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
I was wondering if you could give me your opinion on deep water drillers and coal. When do you think either of those will rebound?
Okay.
Well, we certainly hope that deep water drillers don't rebound too quickly. Because we want them to stay deep.
Yeah, if we don't want deep water drilling for coal to rebound at all, actually. It's a really dangerous area with not a lot of profit if you're deep water drilling for coal.
It'll be a long time, buddy.
Yeah, all humor aside, there's a nice little chart that has differing levels of depths for drilling and what the cost is. So those drilling platforms that are already in operation are profitable right now. It's the new ones that we won't be seeing for a while, because a new platform being taken out and the new drill hole being made and all the safety apparatus that needs to be put around it is a tremendous front-end expense that right now we wouldn't be able to recoup back for about 5 years, and that's not what the oil companies want to see.
If you believe in the laws of supply and demand, and whether or not you believe in them, they're still there.
I don't believe in the law of gravity.
Well, that's perfectly right.
I don't believe that I just fell down.
Then the supply of oil, of energy producing hydrocarbons, continues to increase, and I mean massively, to the point where we are literally at great risk in the United States, which is, by the way, why West Texas Intermediate is lower than Brent and not rising as fast as Brent, because we're literally running out of places to put oil in the United States. On the other hand,
we don't have any place to put it anymore.
You've got a lot of companies out there that have holes in the ground that they borrowed money to put in the ground, and this is all over the world for that matter.
And they have to pump to pay that debt back, because you can't say, sorry, I can't pay the debt because the...
Yeah, and this is the thing. We're going to see bankruptcies,
yeah,
and we're going to see these oil fields being sold off for a fraction of what everybody thought they were worth. And there, matter of fact, there's a potential danger to the banks at this point. One of the things the Federal Reserve was doing in its recent stress test is, what if oil falls to $20 a barrel? And, of course, what's that got to do with the bank? Well, guess who made all the loans? Banks made the loans to these oil drillers and all these offshore deep rig drilling, very expensive, very much done on borrowed money. And if oil, most of those major recent operations require oil above $60 a barrel to break even, and it's at 40-something. I didn't look at it today, but it's at 40-something, And frankly, there's a lot of indication right now that the prices are being held artificially high through some manipulation. I can easily see in the 30s, I can conceive of $20 oil. And at $20 oil, the only organization on the planet that's going to be making money is Saudi Arabia, but they spend money faster than they're going to do off of that. So it's going to be interesting.
If it were only a corporate thing, there would still be profitable in Saudi Arabia, except that it's a governmental thing and all of their expenses are part of the oil profits, so they're not going to be making... They're going to be in the red, too.
Now, if Russia decides to go to war with NATO, the price of oil will go up, but that's a very expensive way to get the job done.
Now, having said that, with coal being the next question... It's the same question, because a lot of the reason why the deep sea drilling is not so profitable is we started fracking. And one of the interesting and wonderful byproducts of fracking is natural gas, which is a direct competitor of coal. And when you have huge amounts of natural gas that are basically just coming out at record speeds, it means that coal's not going to be able to keep up for a while. Coal is still very cheap, but it's very dirty to burn. And with the EPA putting extra regulations on burning of coal, it makes it more expensive than natural gas right now.
And last but not least, history tells us that hydrocarbon fuel prices, and that includes coal and oil, go through very long and very large cycles.
Go back to the 80s, the early 80s, we had a crash in oil prices.
Right.
And anybody that's lived in Texas very long remembers the Midland-Odessa cratering of...
Not to mention Houston.
Houston and the people that had these amazing jobs and these wonderful offices way up at skyscrapers. And when you ask them what they did, they said, well, I work in oil. Well, what do you do? Well, I move these papers from this office to that office and I have a corner office. Well, they lost their jobs because a lot of overhead was there that wasn't needed. And you're going to see that again. So when should it rebound? It will rebound unless we come up with a completely new way of delivering power to our vehicles and to...
Which I think we will probably do.
Yeah. And when the prices start coming back up, we will see it happen. Because when they come back up, it will be much higher than $100 a barrel. But that will be...
A long time from now. And the other thing is, very frankly, there is a tremendous amount of research going into batteries. Now, you may think, what's that got to do with oil? The concept is there, if we can figure out how to keep it from catching on fire, of creating batteries.
Specifically, the research
is lithium batteries.
Lithium ion batteries.
Lithium metal batteries, right? Not the ion. They literally take, the ions are forming.
The same thing. It's a lithium barrier to ions. It allows them to pass.
But actually having a lot more lithium in the battery makes the battery phenomenally effective, and
wafers.
You could literally have a car that you could drive around all day, drive conceivably as much as you can drive on a tank of gasoline now on one charge. However, there's this little problem that lithium, when it's exposed to oxygen, bursts into flame.
Ooh.
So can we overcome that? Well, we had the same problem with gasoline at one point. So
we still have that problem with gasoline. If you think about the number of car fires that happen,
But they're manageable at this point.
Yeah, and I think that technology is coming along with the lithium batteries that they're basically laptop batteries. We carry laptops around. They're basically cell phone batteries. And, yes, you do hear about occasionally a cell phone battery catching fire and hurting someone. But
you do?
I have heard because I listen to these things. But they're generally one person out of 10 million versus a car fire, which is about one every five accidents.
And one of the things that isn't going to likely stop, which it did in the past, is the supply side, the demand side of the equation. In each cycle during the 20th century, the demand side of the equation shrunk. And we produce a lot more oil, but in the United States today, per capita, we're using far less oil than we were using 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 60 years
1982 ago. 1982 is a good number. I've got numbers on that. We were using approximately half the oil per capita. Each person is using half of the oil that a person was using in 1982. Mm-hmm. And people say, how is that even possible? We're driving more. We have more cars. Well, yes, it was a very nice gas mileage to have 8 miles per gallon in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
And you generally don't find new cars being made that are less than about 30. I mean, the higher 20s, right, upper 30 area, and they're talking about 50. And when you're talking about electric cars or hybrids, you're in the 50s, and the electric cars are, that doesn't even really compute because it's not gas. Mm-hmm.
And because this is a really long cycle, the people who will do, who will be the majority voters, if and when the price of oil ever starts to think about recovering is an absurd concept, oil doesn't think, but will be the millennials. And for a couple of reasons. Number one, Xers don't vote very much, and B, there's a lot of millennials being born and growing up. Now, this is, and so the issue then is, what is their attitude towards this? And their attitude is, they are deeply concerned, almost universally, about the environment, want to keep pushing for electric cars and greater miles per gallon and greater fuel efficiency and less air pollution. So it's a really poor bet to bet on coal and oil at this point.
Now, I'm going to come in with some good news about that. Not that low gas prices is bad news to most people, but when you're talking about the cratering of a huge portion of the economy in Texas, a huge portion being 5% of our economy is wrapped up in that. Most people think it's higher than that. We put out a lot
of
oil.
It used to be.
We have diversified. About a year and a half ago, we were concerned about what was going over in in the Asian watery area. The oceans around Asia were becoming near war zones. China and Japan and Korea were busy making rattling noises with their sabers and yelling at each other. And
I didn't even know they carried sabers on ships.
Evidently they do, because the headlines all talked about saber rattling happening. And the reason why they were doing that is because there were some deep sea reserves of oil out there, and they wanted to increase their territorial jurisdiction on where they could start drilling. And now they don't really want to do that because it costs a lot of money to get that oil out, and the money won't be recouped anytime soon. And Russia was sending submarines to plant Russian flags on the floor of the ocean over the North Pole because there's oil reserves out there. Mm-hmm. And they were arguing with Canada, and they were arguing with the United States and with Finland and Denmark, and all the basically any northern facing country was arguing with them. You can't just go out and take the ocean floor. Mm-hmm. That's not what we have as international law. Well, they're not talking about doing that anymore. So there's a whole bunch of good news on the political spectrum on the aggressiveness that was being shown in the international community about claiming land that had oil under it or in it somehow has fallen way off. And now it's just the people that rested all of their eggs in the basket of oil. How's that for a mixed metaphor? Oil baskets. What is the price per oil basket these days with eggs in them? For Putin, I think that price of the oil basket with eggs on it has gone through
that before. Makes sense. Anyway, does that answer your question?
Yeah, but I'm looking for a sector that could be considered a value sector for me to go ahead and look at.
Good luck.
And I thought that was it. So I
well, now, this is the issue. Very frankly, you look around for some place with great cash flow and deep reserves, and is boring, not seen in the headlines, and you'll find value. Now, I'm not recommending that you invest in any particular sector of the market or anything else, but if you want to speculate on where you think deep value is, by the way, I'll just kind of keep an eye on what Warren Buffett is buying.
Yeah. One of the things that we talk about here is that, well, as I just said, with the extremely mixed metaphor of the oil basket with eggs in it, if you're looking for a sector to put your money in, you're probably not doing it right.
Well,
because that's a big bet.
Of the money. It's but not, it's a, you know.
Right, it's a speculation, and I understand that. But there's some pretty good guidelines. A lot of books have been written on that, and they're pretty well off. For example, we used to, and I'm not going to say it anymore because it's not public anymore. It got bought. But Kansas City Southern Railroad was an excellent example. Nobody was talking about it. It was I used to use that as an example of a value stock, and I can use it very freely right now because it's not available to be purchased anymore. But Kansas City Southern have deep pockets. They had lots of land that they owned. They had trains full of stuff that we use and desperately need, and there was no other way to get them from the East Coast to the West Coast and vice versa. And they were trading at like 6 times earnings at the time I was mentioning that. And then they went up to 9 times earnings. Pretty clearly, and this was the fascinating thing, if you dug down deep and looked at it, you would discover at that point that the real estate that they owned under their tracks was more valuable than their total stock outstanding on the New York Stock Exchange. There's an example of how to start finding an under note, but you got to dig deep, and if it's in the newspapers, it ain't going to be any good. Okay,
understand.
All right,
thanks for the call.
So that's, you know, Warren Buffett said the way he used to find these things is he would read deep in the Omaha, and he'd read the Omaha local newspaper,
right,
whatever that is, and he'd read the Wall Street Journal, the paper version, and the incidental little stories deep in the papers where he would find his ideas to start looking for companies. But that's just an idea to start looking, and sometimes you can find an entire sector. But here's the problem with that. Fair warning. Something that is undervalued can stay undervalued a long time.
Yeah. I made a reference just a minute ago to South Korea, Japan, and China. So I will make a further reference.
SKJC.
Yes.
It could be the new brick.
They're meeting this week. And they're going to sit down in Seoul, South Korea, and have conversations about everything they've been arguing about. And it sounds very warm. Most of the argument sounds like it's going to be more about World War II than about territorial waters.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why they are on the books meeting is to discuss this territorial dispute. It sounds like it's going to go away.
And they also may mention North Korea at some point.
Oh, yeah. North Korea may come up in the conversation. Probably not on the record, though.
Yeah.
Because they don't want North Korea to feel like they are worth mentioning on the record.
So we have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir, guys. Enjoy the show. I read that Richard Fisher out of Dallas is suggesting that the Fed add 2 additional banks to the system. Can you guys comment on that? What's his rationale for that? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
There have been a lot of talk over the years about the size of the Fed network. The Federal Reserve is a network of banks, and the big banks are the ones that make the decisions for the little banks. And when little banks get bigger, they want a voice. And if there's a lot of commerce happening in an area and the Federal Reserve is looking at it through too high up on the network, they don't get data as clearly. So there's a lot of chatter, and it happens all the time, about whether to drop banks or add banks. In this case, it's probably a good idea to add a couple of banks to the Federal Reserve. The commerce, after the recession, the way our economy is distributed across the country has changed. If you look at Illinois and, well, just say the word Detroit and people get the idea, there used to be a lot of money moving into the system in Detroit, and it's moved. There's a lot of money coming into the system in the Dallas area, the Fort Worth area. But if you look around and you realize that Houston and Austin And if you go west, you start seeing other things. If you go east, we've moved the landscape of our economy with this recession. It changed the way, if you were kind of looking at it as a topographical map, where hotspots for commerce, what the Federal Reserve is trying to do is stay on top of that. Now, there's a political process that goes on there, too. And sometimes people just want to be in the Federal Reserve because they want to be political. That's where you got to draw the line. You got to figure out what is the best way to read the data, and are you doing research on the particular question here?
Well, I know the thing about – there's a couple of things about Mr. Fisher that are worthy of note. I was reading some of them this morning before I came in. You know, he's retired. And on the way out the door, he said some things. But Richard Fisher – as a member of the Federal Reserve, has often had the flashiest quotes. He's often known as the most right-wing.
He's often known as the most wrong, but never in doubt.
And but he's never boring. Frankly, I don't know that there would be anything. I don't know that
New York Times headline: Richard Fisher often wrong, but seldom boring. So the people that know about him basically are saying the same things.
The issue of whether to have more Federal Reserve banks, very frankly, I think it'd be a terrible idea. He is like I said, he's somewhat to the right politically, and he believes that more devolvement of power is better. But the issue is you got 11 Federal Reserve banks, and there's a very good reason. I think it's 11 or 12. I don't remember which.
I think it's still 11.
But this is the – and not all of them get to vote at every meeting. They rotate the vote around. You get much larger than that, and it really comes down to something very simple. We only have so many fingers. And once we get – this is why the Army and –
there's 11. There's 12.
There's 12? There's 11 regular banks in the New York Bank.
Yeah.
And the New York Bank has more power and has a permanent voting seat and is sort of different. So there's 11 real banks. Then there's the New York Bank. And, of course, then the one that's in Washington that's not a Federal Reserve Bank, it is the Federal Reserve.
Right. And, the question
us up to 13, which is the Christ number, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the number of disciples.
12 disciples plus Christ. So,
if you look at the map on the Federal Reserve Board's website, you'll see that in the Northeast there's a whole bunch of banks, and in the West, covering California, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, New Mexico,
there's only half a bunch.
There's one.
Yes.
Basically, a quarter with Alaska, it's more than a quarter of the geographical area of the United States is covered by one bank. Texas has part of New Mexico and a little bit of Louisiana.
That's basically the way that the revolutionaries wanted to set it up anyway.
It doesn't quite stretch up as far north as the original map of the country of Texas, but it's pretty close to that kind of look.
Yeah.
So when we're looking around, having a couple more banks might be a good idea, just so that everybody's represented as far as the economy is concerned.
I think California needs its own bank, but I think they got the optimal number of people on a committee. You get more people on the committee than they've got.
And you just never get anything done. Just look at Congress.
Like, yeah.
No, don't look at Congress.
Don't look at Congress, no. I mean, we had a caller, but they hung up.
Yeah. Smart caller.
Yeah. The thing is that in human endeavors,
as opposed to sheep,
exactly, once you get more than 13 people trying to accomplish something, it starts to break down, and there's no coincidence.
Sheep are pretty good at it. When you get a bunch of them together, they run around, they go in the same direction, they all
follow a bellwether, which is a neutered male wearing a bell,
right,
which is probably not optimal.
That's not what we're doing.
So the issue is that, very frankly, I know this is kind of sounds like I'm being a little on the weird side here as opposed to the lot on the weird side that I normally am, but 13 is an optimal number for a group, and this comes from my cultural anthropology.
Except that the group itself is actually more than 13. There's 15 people on the board because you've got three appointed by the president, approved or reviewed by the Senate, and then you have the bank heads.
Mm-hmm. So the Federal Reserve Board is probably a little bigger than it needs to be now. And as that's reason, by the way, that's the reason they decided to limit the voting.
I think they should redistrict. I do. I think because...
So that you'd have all the Republicans in Federal Reserve Bank?
No. I don't think it should be done politically, but I think it should be done based on the economies of the area, because that's what they're supposed to be doing. One of the purposes of the Federal Reserve now, which it wasn't until recently, was to calm the markets. And if they don't have the data to do that properly, they can't calm the markets. And when they're spread out in some areas and concentrated in others, we get a distorted view of reality. Mm-hmm. It's that view of you've got New York and New York. And that's
a
problem.
One of the things that's happened since the crisis and the bills that were passed and the reorganization in finance that's gone on, one of the things that's happened is the power of the New York Bank has been reduced. A lot of the way that the New York Bank used to control the financial world, as opposed to the trading and financial world, as sort of a centerpiece, which echoes back, by the way, to the time when New York was the headquarters of the Federal Reserve at one point, and the president of the New York Bank was also the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. And we went to a separate Federal Reserve headquarters in D.C., and what we've seen happen since 2009 is a very significant portion of the power that the New York Bank used to hold has now moved to Washington, D.C., and that is an ongoing issue, and I think it's probably a good one.
Yeah, because
they basically shoveled or swept or whatever a lot of evidence that everything was going to fall apart that the New York Bank knew about under the rug and said, oh, well, because they have a really cozy relationship. As a matter of fact, Hank Paulson, who was the, but you go down this list of people, it's Goldman Sachs, chairman, president of New York Fed, Secretary of the Treasury was just kind of a career path.
Right. You just do these things, and so when you retire, you've got all the little labels that you need to stick on your wall.
But the point is that the New York Bank traditionally has had, president of the New York Bank is not confirmed by Congress. He's not nominated by the president. He's elected by the banks in the New York District. Well, the banks in the New York District take whoever the most luminous and well thought of bank president that they have in that area, and they make that person historically the president of New York Fed. And
the
relationship was a little cozy there, to say the least.
The last time we had a redistricting was in 1996, and the entire topographical map of the economy has shifted since then. New York has, during that entire period, been shrinking in population as well as economic might. Texas has been growing. California has grown some and then shrunk some. Florida is much more important than it used to be. And when you look up in the north, the Chicago, St. Louis areas have had some massive hits. The St. Louis Fed should probably get shrunk and more space given to the other areas because the economic...
So the head,
impact
the
is,
head the head Fed should get shrunk.
Oh yeah, shrink the heads. Wait a minute.
That sounds
like
good.
New Guinea or something.
Yes, as opposed to the old Guinea.
We want the Federal Reserve to visit New Guinea.
Yes, and we. Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the Personal Wealth Coach is a something that the Personal Wealth Coach produces. Two separate organizations. And it is on Town Square Media's KTEM, and Town Square Media, in order to pay the electric bill, has comicals that they like us to play. I mean commercials. And so we're going to play some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to give us a call on the other side of commercials, and if today is March 21st, 2015, where you are, then give us a call at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. Happy first day, full day of spring.
First day, full day?
Yes.
Of spring. Okay. Yes. Good. Happy day after equinox.
Yeah.
Vernal.
Vernal equinox.
Yes. Okay. We'll be back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Lapsed into 2002 was in large part because of 401ks and other retirement plans where people were investing their money in the S&P 500 stock index. Because if you look at the stocks that occupied, that had soaked up the vast majority of the money that was invested, it wasn't the tech stocks. That's the funny thing. It was the largest stocks in the S&P 500. So that the top five stocks in the S&P 500 in 2000 had 50% of the new S&P 500 money going into it. Well, what happens then, people move in these gigantic herds, and all these people who were putting their money in S&P 500 index funds, largely because a guy named John Bogle was singing that song.
He was the founder of Vanguard. We like Vanguard. John Bogle is a little bit of a hypocrite.
Yeah, and so a lot of people dumped a lot of money into S&P 500 stock index funds because they were going up. So if you want an artificiality to it, it's not really an artificiality, it's just reality, which sounds a little same. The people who invest in 401ks are often not the most sophisticated investors in the world, but they think they are. And as a result, they tend to chase high performance. And as they chase high performance, they make things that are already overpriced get more overpriced until somebody starts to sell, and then there's a panic. So they increase the volatility of the market.
Most people, when they look at their 401k and they say, what are my options, they just look at a few numbers. And there's a number on the side. Everybody gets this on their 401ks. This is their performance number. And you have a performance number going down the side, and people tend to go, well, I want to put my money where it's doing the best.
Where it will do the best.
Or where it will do the best.
And they believe strongly what it says at the bottom. Past performance is guarantee of
it. It is no guarantee.
They miss the knot. Okay?
There's a big knot in there. When you look at
Gordian knot.
Right. When you look at a performance number on your 401k and when you're making decisions on that, that shouldn't be the reason why you put the money in there. It should be part of the reason.
Oh yeah, but they believe in the old dictum, which is buy high, sell low.
Right. When that number is really high, it means it's done well. It means it's way up. And when a lot of people look at their 401k and they say, I want to put my money where it's doing well, they don't understand that doing is different than done. Done well does not mean doing well. And a lot of people put their money in positions that have just done well, which causes them to jump up even further, which has...
And eventually,
somebody starts selling, and then if the reason why you bought something is because it's going up, then the reason why you sell it is because it's going down, and that's the opposite of what you want to be doing in the market.
Yeah, and it's so 401ks have distorted the market. They've made it higher, and one of the reasons, by the way, that the market plunges are not as bad as they have been at times in the past is because people have gotten a little more rooted in their 401ks, and they tend to stick there a little longer.
Right. They don't want to liquidate because there's tax disadvantages.
A huge chunk of the panic that occurred between 2007 and 2009 of the market decline and then bounced back up as we said it would, the reason it went from actually not particularly overpriced to horribly underpriced was because of people bailing out of 401k investments.
Well, here's the next thing just to put a little perspective on here.
Uh-oh.
If you have a restaurant, we're going to use a little village of Salado as an example. They have one grocery store in Salado. It's Brookshire Brothers.
Yes.
And it's got a pretty good selection for a little village. It's not the greatest grocery store in the world, but it's pretty good for a village. It's pretty good. If you have a series of restaurants open up there and they don't want to ship in their own produce, that will artificially, with air quotes around the word artificially, raise the price of the produce at that Brookshire Brothers because there's a higher demand on the produce. They can raise the prices and people will still buy it.
You're another believer in the mythical law of supply and demand.
I am. It's amazing. Yeah. So really what's happening there is somebody could say that that restaurant is an artificial demand. The problem with that concept is that the people that live in Salado eat at the restaurant. So who's eating the produce? They may be eating more of the produce, but the restaurant is willing to pay a higher amount because they're going to charge a higher amount when they cook it.
Mm. course, so, it gets a little more complicated from there.
Yeah, then it starts getting into really weird chains of who's buying what, where, when, and why.
And then another grocery store opening up. And
right. So
are people driving to Belton?
Which could lower the price of produce again. So
right.
That supply and demand issue, when you have 401ks that are basically restaurants in every village in the United States, yes, produce prices are higher, but who's eating the produce? The same people are eating them.
Yeah, and so, believe me, a lot of people, by the way, you're talking about the money going in every week. A lot of people have looked for a little price spike every week as the money is.
Yeah.
But the problem is, when your paycheck is issued, it doesn't necessarily instantly go in. Your portion doesn't. It's there's a staggered event over the week during the, for the 401k. So no one's been able to find a little price jump on payday.
Well, once the computers get good enough that it's an immediate purchase, then people will be able to get front running on that. But then once people realize that they front run it, then they'll go back to what they're doing today.
Yeah.
Only they'll do it more efficiently.
Yeah. What happens?
People supply and demand again.
If there ever is the least little peak that starts to kick in on payday,
the quants will find it.
The quants will find it, and they'll be buying on non-payday and selling on paydays using their super fast computers. Well, we've got some more commercials to play. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back after these words from Town Square sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone numbers in here have not changed, despite the fact that we have moved literally thousands of miles through space since I last mentioned it. 773-1400
or 1-866-597-1400.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello, this is Bill from Temple. I'm thinking about taking out a mortgage, and I was wondering if you have any preferences on someone to help me handle this mortgage.
Boy, that's a hard. That's a.
Okay, let's kind of rewind and start at the beginning. You're taking out a mortgage because you're buying a house.
Yes.
Okay, and do you currently have a house?
I'm not. I'm just buying this house. I'm not.
Okay.
Okay. Is it a house that you plan on living in?
Yes.
Okay, so it's not going to be a rental.
No.
Okay.
Do you have a long-term relationship with a bank?
Yes, pretty well.
Well, you actually know the people in the bank, or?
Not that well. Month-to-month transactions and stuff.
Okay.
Well,
I've never made a loan from them, but I've got good credit.
Well, the issue is, very frankly, shop around.
Yeah, and there's some easy places to do that and some hard places to do that.
So, check my bank out.
Well, before you check your bank out, what you're going to have to know, there's some things that you need to know right away.
Okay.
Every time you talk to a mortgage company of some kind, whether it's your bank or somebody else's bank or another bank somewhere else, they're going to want to run your credit. And every time they do that, it's going to show up on your credit report. Your credit report is going to be part of what everybody's looking at. So when you shop around, first what you want to do, there's bankrate.com, you can go to lendingtree.com. There's a whole series of places that
I would hesitate to go to LendingTree.
LendingTree is going to release your information to everybody, and everybody will start calling you immediately.
And you will get spammed nearly to death by those guys.
Right. If you go to bankrate.com, which I prefer more, you'll be able to see what the going rate is for interest rates. Now,
for a mortgage, and you can actually say if you want a mortgage of a certain time period and you want, you tell them where you are on Bankrate, and they will give you a list of mortgage companies and banks that are offering mortgages in the area and what their points are and what their interest rate is.
Yeah, the rate right now is averaging around for a 30-year loan around 3.87%.
I won't need that. Maybe 5 to 10 years.
Okay, well, a 10-year is about 3.13.
Right, and so you go to bankrate.com. That's the first place you go. Very frankly, my experience is when you contact the lowest interest rate person or bank for Texas, for your area of Texas, because they actually narrow it down to your area in Texas.
Yes, Bell County.
What I'm saying is when I think they have the Fort Hood, Killeen, Temple, Belton area or something. They always throw College Station in there for some reason. Any rate, like they're next door to us. I guess we're all right wing people, I guess. Anyway, the once you find the lowest on there, in most cases, my experience is people have said, okay, and they contact them, whoa, this is a lot less expensive than I can. And the thing is, don't get hung up on getting a local mortgage broker, and I'm going to have some of them really angry at me about this probably. And the reason I say that, they're going to unload that loan so fast, they won't even have their fingerprints on it. No matter who it is you get it from, it's gone to somebody else in minutes.
Okay, so first you check the rate.
No,
it's a contract. They're locked in.
So first check the rates. Next, check your credit report.
Okay.
Annualcreditreport.com is the website that's authorized by the U.S. government to actually give you your free credit report.
Yeah, but don't go to freecreditreport.com.
No, because
they're not
that's
free.
Not free.
But annual report is.
Annualcreditreport.com gives you the ability to get your credit report from each of the three bureaus, each of the three credit bureaus that track credit. So you can stagger that out over the year and get three credit reports over a year, or if you're really interested, you could grab it all at once. I would prefer not. So we're all about out of time, unfortunately. We'll talk more about this next hour.
Thanks, Carl. Okay, and you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back next hour.
Texas News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.